Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. Here's what I remember from the last time I was in a hospital for surgery. Somebody brought me a gown. They took my clothes. I remember the nurse calling me Honey Bunny before she jabbed a needle into my hand. She said, "Here comes a big ouch, Honey Bunny." The crew huddled around me in the OR, repeating my name and why I was there, to have an umbilical hernia repaired.
Give me 10 more big, slow, deep breaths.
Then my anesthesia started working. I was counting backwards. 10, 9.
In about 2 minutes,
eight,
you may feel your eyelids
seven,
start to get very
six,
heavy.
Five,
you may start to feel very relaxed.
Three, two.
I remember my throat feeling really dry and scratchy when I woke up, being completely out of it. And then, a while later, I was sitting in a wheelchair being pushed through a revolving door to go home. I felt taken care of and safe, but also like every part of this experience was out of my hands. When you go to the hospital, you're not in control of so many things, like how long you have to wait, who will examine you or be on your surgery team. Will your nurses and doctors be kind and caring, or rushed and a little bit rude? All that shapes the experience and ultimately how you feel about hospitals.
So sterile, it's so impersonal, but it's also not at the same time.
Yeah, I think about kind of last resorts.
The staff were just really respectable and very polite and courteous, and the place was very clean.
Somewhere I don't want to go, because every time I'm there, I got a problem.
For patients, so much of what happens in hospitals is a mystery. We're funneled through, given access to some places and not others, just hoping to come out better on the other side. On this episode, we go behind some of those staff-only doors and get a better sense of the inner workings of hospitals. Let's start with a topic lots of patients worry about, infections, the kind you catch in the hospital. They are really hard to control and they can be deadly. But if you want to find out if a hospital is doing a good job keeping things like staff or MRSA at bay, it's not that easy. It's not like checking if your favorite restaurant got dinged for health code violations. Liz Tung looked into how hospitals get cleaned, and it turns out it's pretty complicated.
I'm following Erica Guadalupe down the hallway of Nazareth Hospital in Philadelphia.
It's a utility cart that carries all our equipment.
Her cart is piled high with spray bottles, along with rags and buckets and mops. Erica likes the job, though she says patients aren't always happy to see her.
For me to be hardest is when they don't want me to clean the room and they'll just sit there the whole day so I can't touch the room. That's the hardest part for me.
But Erica isn't here to chase dust bunnies or fluff pillows. It's a lot more involved than that. She's part of Environmental Services, and they're on a mission to find and destroy dangerous germs using any means necessary.
We have a microfiber cloth that we use to wipe all of our surfaces.
That's Kevin Agan, Nazareth's Director of Environmental Services. He's showing me how they clean patient rooms, which pretty much involves sanitizing everything they can.
So we use a hydrogen peroxide-based disinfectant, and it has to sit on the surface for 2 minutes in order to be effective against germs.
He says mainly they're focusing on what Kevin calls the high-touch surfaces.
The TV remote, the telephone, the bed rails, tables, chairs, light switches.
But there's a customer service part to it, too. Kevin says cleaners make a point to talk with patients, greet them, tell them what they're doing. He shows me notes they leave near the bed and on the bathroom mirror that say when the room was last cleaned and who did it.
So we want to make sure that we talk to our patients every day to let them know that their room has been keeping them safe while they're here.
Safety is the key word. Yes, hospital cleanliness is important for aesthetic reasons and patient satisfaction, but the main reason it matters is keeping patients safe from what are called hospital-acquired infections, or HAIs. Hospitals are one of the easiest places to contract an infection because, of course, they're full of sick people. Every year, nearly 2 million patients get sick with HAIs, and almost 100,000 die. You've probably heard of some of them. MRSA, Staph, C. diff. American hospitals have made a lot of progress on HAIs over the past few decades, but according to microbiologist Jonathan Eisen, there's still a major threat.
What is really scary is that many hospitals have antibiotic-resistant or antifungal-resistant microbes, and some of those are basically untreatable. And that's terrifying.
Jonathan is at UC Davis, and one of the things he studies is the spread of antibiotic-resistant microbes. It's something he has a personal stake in, too. That's because about 2 years ago, he got some bad news. He had a tumor, and his doctor said he'd need surgery to get it removed.
Yeah, I mean, it is a big concern for me from a personal point of view. I'm a diabetic, so surgery is potentially a little riskier for me, and just worried about the possibility of a hospital-acquired infection.
Diabetics in general heal more slowly and have lower immunity, both of which make them more vulnerable to infections. So Jonathan decided to do some research and find out which of the hospitals he was considering had the highest and lowest infection rates.
You know, I went to this oracle known as Google, basically, like everyone else does. And thankfully, the state of California has a useful website with information about this.
Theoretically, this kind of info should be available about most hospitals. That's because around 2011, the federal government started requiring hospitals that receive Medicare funds to report their infection rates, which it then released publicly to help increase accountability. A few years later, the Affordable Care Act tied infection rate performance to federal funding as a kind of carrot and stick approach to get hospitals to improve. Both were part of a recent push to get more serious about HAIs. Past efforts have focused on three main areas: hand hygiene, medical devices like catheters and ventilators, and overuse of antibiotics. But a few years ago, healthcare epidemiologists realized that those factors didn't account for everything.
We were recognizing that as much as we were doing interventions on a national level to decrease healthcare-associated infections, that there was still a piece that we were missing.
That's Jennifer Hahn. She's an infectious disease epidemiologist at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. And the missing piece she's talking about, it turned out to be environmental contamination, meaning germs that inhabit the space around patients. Doorknobs, tables, remotes, all those high-touch surfaces that environmental services make sure to wipe clean every day. Jennifer told me that recent research has shown that germs from these surfaces could account for as much as 30% of HAIs, which got me curious.
Why can't we just clean everything with bleach and be done with
it? Yeah. So certainly we do clean a lot of things with bleach, but there's a lot of complexity behind it.
Jonathan says a lot of that complexity has to do with the fact that you're dealing with lots of different kinds of bacteria.
There's incredible diversity there that makes it very challenging to, you know, develop means to control all of them. The way you might control one of them might inhibit your ability to control another one.
For instance,
Bacillus anthracis, the causative agent of anthrax, forms spores that are incredibly resistant to everything you throw at it, including irradiation, including even potentially bleach and other things, whereas other bacteria, you know, you look at them funny and they die.
And then you've got diversity in your patient pool. For instance, you might need to clean a room differently for a patient whose immune system is compromised or who comes in with a treatment-resistant infection. All of these variables play into how hospitals approach cleanliness, which they all do differently. Because, as it turns out, there are no national requirements for how hospitals clean, only guidelines laid out by the CDC.
However, in terms of best practices for certain types of disinfection, and in particular for how we monitor whether disinfection and cleaning has been done adequately or appropriately, there's a huge, huge variation among hospitals, among different institutions.
Jennifer says there's a surprising reason for that, which she and several colleagues discovered in a study a few years ago. It was commissioned by the government, and their job was to find out which cleaning practices are best at preventing hospital-acquired infections. So Jennifer and her co-authors reviewed all the studies they could find about hospital cleaning practices. And this is what they found.
We don't know what is the best practice in terms of cleaning, specifically comparing one process to another. Similarly, we don't know what's the best practice for monitoring how well something is cleaned by environmental services staff.
We still don't know the best way to clean in order to prevent infections. And that's not all. According to that same report, we don't even have a working definition of what clean means. Does it mean zero microbes and organisms, or does it just mean fewer? Or can we only measure clean by the fact that patients aren't getting infections?
For us, you know, when we define clean, we want the definition of clean to be some type of benchmark where we're seeing a reduced risk of transmission.
That's a frontier that Jennifer and other researchers are just starting to explore. She says we may need to rethink what clean means in a hospital setting.
You know, the goal of environmental cleaning disinfection is not to make all of our surfaces or high-touch objects sterile, continuously sterile. It's certainly not that. It's to reach a certain threshold by whatever measurement that we're substantially reducing the risk of transmission. So really thinking of that patient-centered outcome.
According to Jonathan Eisen, the biologist from before, a lot of people are starting to think this way.
There's a movement among some people to start to think about not sterilizing every environment like a hospital. Complete sterilization does not seem to be a useful target.
Instead, some researchers are moving toward improved surveillance, meaning doing a better job of tracking infections in hospitals and where they might be starting. That way, we can figure out how they're being transmitted and try to set up roadblocks rather than just trying to obliterate these microbes altogether. But for now, spritzing and spraying may be the best we have.
Usually we clean everything a patient can touch. Everything.
That story was reported by Liz Tung. We're talking about hospitals, how they work, how we experience them as patients. I get lost in hospitals all the time. It just happened the other day when I had to get a mammogram.
Is this the second floor? Or did I stop somewhere else? Oh, yeah, it is the second floor. Can I help you? I'm looking for a radiology.
Thank God for helpful employees. Hospitals can feel like a maze. You're wandering down the corridor, moving from one floor to another. Then it turns out you have to go across the parking lot to a totally different building. Architect Aaron Nunes Cooper says the reason for that is often that these buildings have been expanded and expanded over time.
Things have to get adapted and fit into an existing hospital into a space that it wasn't necessarily designed for. And as a result, it can be very confusing to experience that building, to walk through. The wayfinding may not be clear.
Wayfinding in hospitals, that's one of the things Erin specializes in at the architecture firm where she works, Ballinger. And Erin says the maze situation can create a lot of angst.
It's just confusing. They're filled with anxiety. They may come to the building at a time when they're very stressed. And that just compounds an already difficult place to navigate.
Yeah. And I would think it results probably in a lot of extra time for the people who work there, just walking from...
Absolutely. They have to make sure they know where their patients are. They have to make sure that the family members are there. And so sometimes when we're designing from scratch, that idea of mapping what's that experience, how do we kind of take out all those extra unnecessary steps and just make it much more clear.
In addition to mapping out how people get from point A to point B, she tries to envision how the building might change over time.
Even a few years later, there are already changes being made because technology evolves faster than the rate at which facilities are replaced. And so we're often now thinking about how can we design a building that has within it some flexibility.
Is there anything that signals hospital from a building, or does a hospital nowadays look like a bank, look like a university?
When I think of hospital in a stereotypical way, I think of a big patient ward or a building that is just kind of a nondescript block with windows for patient rooms. And I think that now hospitals can have an identity that reflects that they're a state-of-the-art center for care that can also be more welcoming. So a current and modern hospital, when we see that identity, really kind of from the exterior should send a message that it's a welcoming place and it's a place to kind of heal rather than a place to just be sick.
How do you say that in architect?
How do we say that in architect? A lot of it is said in the design that we come up with, in the materiality that we choose, in the scale and in the texture. And having this idea that a building can be made of materials that are calming or that have a texture that people can relate either to their home or to nature or to something that's a little more familiar than what might be an intimidating machine of a hospital.
So glass, yeah. Light.
We love glass. We love light. We love bringing light in. And it actually helps people just have a connection to the outside as a patient if you're recovering or if you're healing, you're in a patient room, but also for staff.
How about noise? Do you have to think about that in your design?
Yes. Having a quiet and calming environment is really important. And so we think about that quite a bit in the design. And acoustics come into play where we have to keep in mind patient privacy. So we want to make sure that you can't hear a conversation happening from one room to the other. But then also inherent within healthcare is there's a lot of machines, there's a lot of equipment, there are a lot of buzzes and a lot of beeping. And to really design spaces that have materials that can help address that so that it's not so loud as a patient when you're in the space.
Tell me about some of the spaces that we as patients don't access and don't use. Yeah. What are some rooms that I'll probably never set foot into?
Hospital loading docks are a lot of fun. There's a lot of coming and going in a hospital loading dock and a separation of clean materials, sterile materials, and soil materials coming in and out. Hospitals will even have radioactive materials. And so just all of the inner workings in that end of the hospital are fascinating to me.
When you go to a hospital now as a patient, not as an architect, what do you look for? What do you see? What annoys you?
You know, I look a lot at materials. I often notice if a material isn't holding up, if a corner is chipped, if edges are frayed on any of the materials. It jumps out at me. And I always think that we, as designers, we have to always come up with something better.
Because what does that chipped corner say to me?
Well, that chipped corner could say, where am I? Am I in a place that's going to care for me in the right way? The reality of the constant 24/7 operation of a hospital is real. Any material, there will be dings, there will be scratches, but how can we really just design with that in mind?
Erin Nunes Cooper is an architect at a firm called Ballinger. She specializes in healthcare design. We're talking about the inner workings of hospitals, the things that make them run smoothly. I was at a hospital in Philadelphia one time to report on a story, and I thought, wow, they have a lot of security here. That's sort of weird. And seriously, a moment later, two people sitting in the waiting room got into a heated argument. It was about to go to blows. The security guards handled it. But often it's healthcare workers right there on the front line when violence happens on the job. Valley Public Radio in Fresno, California looked into how hospitals deal with violence. Laura Zitsui has more.
In downtown Fresno, anyone entering the emergency room at Community Regional Medical Center first meets a security guard and walks through a metal detector.
So if something triggers the metal detector, then they know that they have to get further eyes on that person.
Nicole Osborne is the director of employee health and safety.
Our staff, they're trained to look for behavioral cues as warning signs of somebody that's becoming agitated or violent. So if we can catch somebody in a lower level situation where they're just confused or frustrated, it's easier to de-escalate them.
Nicole says the hospital is constantly making updates and investigating incidents, big and small, to better prevent violent encounters.
I get a ping just about every day. We want everybody to report everything because one of the things that we're fighting is stigma of that violence in healthcare is acceptable.
Hospitals all across California are supposed to have a workplace prevention plan. It's the law. But hospital officials say sometimes it's not until an incident happens that they know what needs improving. Back in December 2017, the CEO at Bakersfield Heart Hospital, Michelle Oxford, got to see her facility's safety procedures in action.
It was on a Friday afternoon around 4:51. A staff member came up and said that there was somebody in the parking lot in the back employee entrance with a weapon.
A man shot into the facility and then walked in with a rifle.
For our hospital, a person with a weapon is a code silver. So we called the code silver overhead. Our staff has had so much training that they know that that means to barricade themselves into whatever areas they are.
Michelle actually encountered the shooter in a hallway as she was checking on her staff. She and her colleague fled.
When Laura and I ran into my office, we both reached for the door to lock it, and there is not a lock because you unlock your door with your key on the outside. So we both sat down and tried to block the door with our bodies. So I don't think that's something you would ever think about without actually experiencing it.
The hospital has since added cameras and so-called Columbine locks, which can be locked from the inside. But again, these are changes made after the active shooter incident. Before that, Bakersfield Heart was already working to comply with California's regulation to decrease healthcare violence. But Gail Blanchard-Sager with the California Hospital Association says the law is largely an unfunded mandate, and facilities have limited resources to comply. That leaves individual safety officers to figure out what needs fixing at their location.
People need to kind of pick what works best for their, you know, downtown LA is different than Madeira.
Gail says medical centers may never eliminate incidents entirely. The emergency department of St. Agnes Medical Center in Fresno sees anyone who comes through their doors, and that includes patients shopping for opioid prescriptions.
They'll say, but these are prescriptions, these were given to me.
That's emergency services director Joyce Eden. She says sometimes things escalate.
We actually have to call Fresno Police Department periodically. We have to notify security because when we let them know we are not able to refill their Norco or other opioid prescriptions that they have, we do get threatened, and we have to take all threats seriously.
Dealing with immediate threats is one part of the job. There's training, and then there's intuition. That comes from experience.
Nurses and physicians will tell you that all the time. You might look perfectly fine, but something inside me is telling me no, it's not, and then we keep digging until we get to that answer.
All staffers get violence prevention education, but ER workers get more training and learn techniques to de-escalate tense situations. The sheer number of people in the ER and waiting around can increase the risk for violence. And safety experts say two big things are sending more people to the emergency room: uninsured patients who come here for everyday primary care, and fewer mental health services available out in the community. Joyce Eden says the higher the volume of patients, the higher risk of incidents. So the hospital has been testing ways to make the department more efficient.
So we initially used to only have one triage desk. If we get past a certain wait time in the lobby, then we'll activate a second triage team. Because if we can get those triages done and figure out what level of care they need, then we can keep that volume in the lobby down and the wait time to figure that out.
It's a decidedly low-tech approach to violence prevention. You know, kind of like when all the lines at the grocery store are long, then they open up another checkout aisle. You can almost feel everyone sigh with relief.
Laura Zitsui reported that story. It was produced with support of the California Fellowship from the University of Southern California Center for Health Journalism. We're talking about hospitals and some of the things that happen behind the scenes that most of us never see or know about. Avir Mitra is an emergency room physician in New York City, and we asked him, what's the strangest thing you encounter in your work? He has this story.
It's hard to come up with just one wild thing that we see in the ER, but I asked around, and there was something a lot of us agreed on.
Maggots.
Oh, maggots.
Maggots.
Maggots. These white, squirmy, wormy things are actually the larval form of the Diptera species. In other words, they're baby flies. It turns out they really thrive in chronic, poorly healing wounds. It's a perfect place for them to grow. And all it takes is one fly to land on that wound for a few seconds, and it can lay hundreds of eggs.
So the first time I saw maggots was my first year as an intern.
That's my friend Kelly Outlaw. She's an ER physician in Maryland. She was treating a man who had wounds on his legs. His bandages hadn't been changed in weeks.
As I'm unwrapping, I just see movement on his legs. And I realize it's maggots. There was thousands of them just wiggling back and forth. And I screamed and I dropped my scissors, and my supervising attending comes running in the room and she's like, oh, it's just maggots. And then she starts laughing at me. Everybody's laughing at me, the nurses, the techs.
Kelly diligently cleaned out every last maggot from the wound. And this becomes a topic of ER water cooler discussions. What's the best way to get rid of maggots? Physician assistant Kevin Nelson likes to irrigate the wound.
If you take like a Ziploc bag and then clip off the tip of it, then you can push water through that. Also using suctions to pull them out of the area.
Naeem Balut works for Doctors Without Borders.
Okay, the best mixture is to use 2 vials of sodium bicarb, 500 cc of normal saline, 500 cc of hydrogen peroxide, 250 cc of betadine.
And I asked plastic surgeon Amit Mitra. Well, he's my dad, full disclosure, but he likes ethyl chloride spray.
And I spray it over the wound where the maggots are, and maggots actually fall off.
As for me, well, I think maybe we should just leave them there. Matter of fact, I might even prescribe them. Okay, let me explain. Diana Dupuy had foot surgery for a bunion and an unhealed fracture. The surgery went well, but
when they took the cast off and I looked at my foot, you'll see those black necrotic wounds. And when I saw that, I was like, oh my goodness, you know, I knew that wasn't good.
Wounds like Diana's are called poorly healing wounds. They're common in diabetics, but they can happen to anyone. And for whatever reason, there's not enough blood flow to the wounded area. As a result, instead of forming a scab and healing, tissue in the wound starts to die. This is called necrosis.
So weeks had gone by and the wound looks worse and worse, right? The necrotic wound just started oozing. It just looked infected. It looked nasty.
Necrotic tissue is the perfect place for bacteria to grow, because without blood flow there, all your natural defenses can't get to it. It's a no man's land. Over time, the bacteria spread and the necrosis expands. Eventually, the bacteria use the dead tissue as a launching pad to infect the rest of you, making you septic and eventually killing you. The standard treatment for this is to grab a scalpel and cut away as much of the dead tissue as possible. That's called debridement. Then you need to take antibiotics to keep the bacteria at bay. And finally, you have to dress the wound and keep it as clean as possible. I can tell you, it's crude, it ain't pretty, but it's what you gotta do. But for Diana, this wasn't working. In fact, it kept getting worse.
And it was at that point I realized I'm in danger of getting a bone infection, which could cause them to amputate my foot.
In her desperation, she remembered a lecture she had heard while earning her degree in clinical laboratory science. It was about maggots, medical maggots.
In the back of my head, out popped the medical maggot therapy, and I started looking into it.
Her search brought her to entomologist and physician Ron Sherman.
I was particularly interested in how insects relate to diseases, usually by causing diseases.
But what if insects could prevent disease? Mentions of maggots and wounds date back thousands of years, and a surgeon in Napoleon's army noted that the war wounds that had maggots seemed to fare better than those that didn't. Doctors during the Civil War made similar observations, but no one had really studied this.
I proposed doing a research project in maggot therapy.
Ron studied poorly healing pressure ulcers and showed that using maggots, 80% of the wounds were free of dead tissue, compared to just 48% using traditional therapy. In addition, those wounds were healing at a faster rate. Because of Ron's research, the FDA actually approved the use of maggots as a medical device in 2004. It was the first time a living creature had been granted FDA approval. Ron started a company called Monarch Labs to sell medical-grade sterile maggots. Fast forward 10 years, and now Diana has a fresh shipment of maggots that her doctor is skeptically getting ready to apply to her foot.
I didn't know how I was going to respond to them. I didn't know if it was going to make me vomit. I didn't know if it was going to make me pass out and dizzy.
The doctor applied a gauze pad full of maggots to the wound and covered it with a breathable dressing.
Maggots that stayed in my wound, they were, you know, they're hungry, right? They immediately start doing their work. It seemed like if when I calmed down, the maggots calmed down, because I was panicked. I was like, oh my God, look at all these maggots.
To her surprise, she wasn't grossed out.
Do not be icked out by these creatures. They're here to help me.
The maggots feasted in the wound for about 2 days.
What you do feel is them getting bigger and they wiggle. You can feel them wiggling around.
So every few days, the dressing would be changed, the bigger maggots removed, and a new batch put in. She did a few sessions like this.
After the first dose, the slough looked like it was almost 75% gone. And that was in just 48 hours.
And now her foot?
Perfect. I can wear stiletto high heel shoes. I ride a motorcycle. It's perfect.
Diana had experienced a true symbiotic relationship with the maggots. Well, at least until...
I felt bad how I had to kill them when I released them. They're doing this great treatment to me and their reward is death, right? I just felt so bad about that.
Okay, so how the heck are these maggots doing a better job with Diana's foot than we are as doctors? Leah Davidoff is a doctor of pharmacy and she studied this.
You put those immature, basically baby flies, into the wound. And basically, just like any baby, they need to feed. And their food is dead tissue.
So point number one is the baby maggots feed on dead, rotting flesh. The same dead flesh that's causing so much trouble in our chronic necrotic wound. To accomplish this, they crawl around the wound, looking for the most rotten parts. They have little rough spines on their skin, so as they crawl, they rake the tissue. This loosens the dirt, so to speak, and separates the dead tissue from the living tissue.
They kind of get into every nook and crevice of the wound.
It's more gentle than the scalpel, and it's more precise. Then they need to eat the tissue, but...
You know how the babies drink milk? They can't have a steak? This is kind of along the same lines.
Baby flies need their food broken down too, so they secrete their digestive enzymes onto the wound. These enzymes liquefy the tissue and turn it into a slough.
And then they just basically snort it up. And that's what they do.
The crazy thing is that these enzymes only affect the dead tissue. The living tissue doesn't dissolve. And there's more.
In the process of doing it, they're also eating up all the bacteria.
See, maggots don't want to die from bacteria either. So their stomachs have evolved to be able to kill bacteria, even some of the most resistant ones out there. In addition, they release unique chemicals onto the wound that cause bacteria to die. So the maggot is debriding better than a surgeon, killing germs better than any antibiotic, and as if that wasn't enough, they somehow seem to accelerate tissue and vascular regrowth. And yet, maggot therapy is still rarely used. According to Ron,
less than 5% of patients who are destined for an amputation are given a trial of maggot therapy, even though published studies show that 50 to 70% of those amputations could probably be prevented.
There are some caveats. The maggots ought to be sterile, and not all species work the same. Most practitioners, including Ron, agree that you should try the standard way first. There can be some pain, and Leah says,
patients do have anxiety, which makes sense because people find it gross. I mean, it's yucky. You put something living on your body and it grosses people out.
It's yucky, it's gross, but sometimes it might be just what the doctor ordered.
That's Avir Mitra reporting. He's an emergency room physician in New York City. We're getting behind some of those staff-only doors, seeing the inner workings of hospitals. And up next, elevators. High-rise hospitals have to make sure that the elevators get critical patients and supplies quickly from one floor to the next without somebody holding the door or stopping at some random extra floor. Newer places have computer systems that take care of that, but at Bellevue Hospital in New York City, it's different. It reminds you of a bygone era. They have elevator operators. Jad Slayman went for a ride.
Not bragging, but everybody likes me. Almost everybody likes me. Not bragging, though.
Everybody knows Sylvia Paris because everybody at Bellevue relies on the elevator, and she's one of the elevator operators. And everyone likes her because she makes a point to make sure they do.
You know, I have to have a nice smile and don't have, like, your face all, like you're frowning or, you know, look like you're mad or something. Don't you have a nice smile on your face? You're sick, you're lying in a hospital bed. And you have, you know, all these things going through your mind. You want to see a nice, pleasant face.
She's letting me tag along for a bit of her shift. Sylvia spends hours in this elevator car.
This is the intercom. So that's where I get the calls. So right now I'm waiting for him to give me a call.
It's busy today, like most here on Manhattan's east side. We don't have to wait long before...
14 to 11 stat. See, now this is a 14 to 11 stat he just gave me. So I go to 14... and pick up the 14, and then they take the person priority call.
STAT is short for statum, Latin for right now. Somewhere in the hospital, somebody needs surgery. On this stat, we pick up a tech with a cart of surgical supplies. He's meeting the surgeons and a patient in the operating room. The calls can be nonstop, up and down 25 stories. But after nearly 3 decades on the job, Sylvia doesn't get frazzled.
Yeah, I see so many different patients in different stages. Some people get shot, some people get stabbed, accident. It doesn't faze me. Sometimes you see a lot of blood.
Sylvia sees the gamut of patients from all over New York City, including a few from the Rikers Island prison. Bellevue has a special area for inmates. We're talking prisoners.
You tell me I remind him of some relative, so he always asks for me.
When the doors open on the 19th floor. It's an inmate, shackled in an orange jumpsuit, flanked by burly NYPD.
Thank you.
The inmate is supposed to go in another elevator, one without, well, me in it. So Sylvia is calling the elevator dispatcher.
Gordon!
He designates elevators specifically for patients, for food, for cleaners and equipment. Basically, mission control. I meet him next.
Yep. Hey, Roswell?
Hey, how you doing?
Oh, Jad, right?
Hey. How you feel?
Today, that dispatcher is Roswell Gordon. Mission control is a small room right behind the elevators. They call it the pilot room.
This is where we control most of the elevators from. It can be crazy at times, but it's good.
It's about the size of an elevator. 3 phones, 2 switchboards, a microphone.
Elevator service, may I help you?
Can I have a 6 to basement, please?
Okay.
Roswell keeps dispatching as we talk without missing a beat. A patient transporter calls, saying floor 1 to floor 4 or something, and Roswell passes the request to the elevator operator in the appropriate car. Newer hospitals have computerized systems for this, touch screens. Bellevue has Roswell. He's the nerve center, routing 1,600 calls a day.
Well, we're talking to the elevator, the person, the operator that's on the elevator right now. We're talking to the sending from floor to floor to pick up whatever they ask to pick up. Elevator service.
19 to the ground, 19 to the ground.
Okay. You have a 19 to ground and 19 to ground. It could be patient we're picking up. It could be just a person that we're picking up.
He's automatic. It's like he's a part of the elevator system. His skill comes from 17 years on the job. But as a rookie...
Crazy. It was like crazy.
It was about like your first day.
My first day, I was nervous like crazy. I was shaking.
It does seem overwhelming, all the switches and lights going off at once.
You got a... 1 to 1 4, 1 to 1 4.
He got the hang of it eventually.
The guys used to tell me, don't worry about it. You can only answer one call at a time. Because sometimes when you first come, you know, you're like, your phone ringing, which one I got to pick up, which one? I said, no, don't worry about that. Worry about that call. Finish that call, then you go to this call. So I try to remember that at all times.
Hello? All elevator operators split their shifts between the pilot room and one of the elevators. Elevator Sylvia service. And Roswell have the same answer when I ask about the best part of the job. They say it's being elevator there for service. The patients.
When they have an operator there, just to talk to them, just to let them know, just to show them it's going to be okay, then you know you're making a big difference, and you know they feel much more comfortable in that way.
But working in an elevator all day, I mean, there's no windows, no water cooler to gossip around. It's even a bit smaller than most cubicles.
Does it get lonely in here?
No.
Just in here by yourself?
No. You won't get lonely because, as you see, the calls kept coming back and forth, back and forth. You have time to get lonely around here. Elevator service?
Yeah, 1 to 14, 1 to 14.
You got a 1 to 1 4, 1 to 1 4.
That story was reported by Jad Slayman. And you know how Sylvia, the elevator operator, said she always makes sure she has a smile on her face to cheer up the patients? Every hospital has employees like that, whether they are wearing scrubs or not. These are people who make everybody's day better in big and small ways. We asked around at different hospitals, tell us about someone who goes above and beyond what their actual job is. That good spirit walking the hallways. At Nemours AI DuPont Hospital for Children in Wilmington, Delaware, they said we should talk to George Benson. George oversees repairs, he builds offices, spackles and paints walls. But to him, it all comes down to this.
We're here for the kids.
George is always running all over the hospital.
From the time you get here to the time you leave, both phones are ringing. You're answering emails. You're just running and trying to get everything done as much as you can with the time you're here.
But he's never too busy to chat with patients. He even stops to play a video game with a little girl in one of the waiting areas.
Yeah, no. Get a whole bunch. Oh, what happened?
I love kids. I love interacting with them. But I also like doing the construction. I like getting down and dirty and doing my job.
Step on it, right where you're at.
Good job. Get him. Good job.
All right.
His attachment to the hospital is also personal. Right before he started this job, doctors here cared for his daughter when she had a really serious respiratory infection.
This place means a lot to me. It saved my daughter's life. My daughter's now 13, and when she was 3 months old, we came in with RSV, and they saved her life. They told us that within 24 hours, she probably wouldn't have been here. So for me to be able to come back here and give to the kids, like the way they did to my daughter, the care, it means a lot. I'm very passionate about what I do here.
George wants to make kids smile, whatever it takes.
We had one child that was here that absolutely loved vacuums. That's when I first started here. So I went out and I bought him a vacuum.
He also volunteers hours and hours of his own time to help put together the hospital's annual prom. It's for current and former patients, kids who are dealing with cancer or other serious health issues.
Roughly 130 kids show up. It is all funded through the community, from the food, the dresses, the tux, the flowers, the entertainment.
The kids get picked up in fancy cars.
From Lamborghinis, Ferraris, Maseratis, and none of them are the same. They arrive here, and the party's on.
As we're walking along the hallway, we run into one of the masterminds behind the prom, Michelle Fulmer. She's a nutritionist in the oncology department. Whatever theme she dreams up for the prom, fire and ice, space exploration, she asks George to make it happen.
I think the most fun request was, George, can you make a volcano on the lawn?
And it happened. And it happened. We had smoke coming out. We had the whole nine yards. It was impressive. And we'll leave it like that.
Does anybody ever say, George, please don't do that again?
Yes, yeah, that's what happened
that's
with
okay.
that one.
George Benson is a construction supervisor at Nemours Alfred I. DuPont Hospital for Children in Wilmington, Delaware. We've been talking about hospitals, the things that happen behind the scenes, and of course, we have to do a little something about hospital romance. It's a popular theme in movies and TV shows like Grey's Anatomy.
I respect you as a man, as a surgeon, as a teacher, I respect you. So, teach me.
Okay, that's a lot. Maybe we'll just talk about friendships in hospitals. Mimi Hayes had brain surgery after a hemorrhage in her cerebellum. It's 2014, she's 22, she had just started her first real job, and now she's laid up, recovering, and learning how to walk again. At her rehab hospital in Colorado, she's the youngest patient by like 50 years, and feeling really alone. What would you do? Swap gossip about the nurses? Mimi made a friend.
It's 8 a.m. and I'm lying in my hospital bed. I fumble for my phone. Maybe a friend will stop by, or maybe there's some interesting guys on Tinder. Nope. Instead, my physical therapist, Vicky, knocks on my door and rolls in with a wheelchair and a pilot gear. Blue smock, yellow face mask, bright blue latex gloves. Not my usual cute gym outfit, but it's protocol. When I arrived, I had a cheek swab to check for nasty viruses like staph. And until the test clears, I have to smock up before I'm allowed to leave my room. As Vicky wheels me down to the gym for therapy, inside all that garb, I'm feeling like patient zero. Vicky drops me off, and while I'm waiting, through the face mask, I see a flutter of movement. It's an old man, with wispy gray hair and suspenders. He must be pushing 90, puttering around the workout equipment like he's tending to his garden. Oh, hi there, darling.
I'm Robin. You know, like the bird.
Hi, Robin the bird. I'm Mimi, like, Mimi. I'd gotten up out of my wheelchair, and I'm still a bit wobbly, so when I see Vicky coming our way, I whisper to Robin, "Meet me tomorrow, dining hall, 7 a.m. Robin slinks into his wheelchair and behind the exercise balls. I've always considered myself an old soul, and I've just landed a date with an old person. Better than any Tinder match. I don't care if he could be my grandpa. This is the most exciting thing to happen to me since, well, my head exploded. Back in my room, I make a list of questions. World War II. Were you there? Grandkids? Are they cute? Male? My age by chance? Finally, I can talk to somebody about my obsession with typewriters and George Gershwin. The next day, I find him. Robin! Over here. This is my spot. His spot? I'm thinking, badass. He must run this dining hall. I jump in. Where were you when Kennedy got shot? Oh my god, can we just talk about the Cuban Missile Crisis? Robin tells me everything. And I listen. About politics and presidents, and the way things were slower back then. He's got a wife, kids, and a grandson who plays jazz. He likes fishing. He's been here for 2 months recovering from a stroke. And that's when Robin tells me he's leaving tomorrow. Robin, you can't leave now. I just got here. It's a little selfish, but I want the old guy to stay. We wrap up our meal, we're rolling to the exit. The nurses aren't really looking. I have to do something big. You want to race, Birdman? Ready? 3, 2, 1, and we're off. Thrusting the wheels as we giggle down the hall. We call it a tie. Oh, good run, my friend. I'll miss you. You'll be okay, kid. He turns and rolls down the fluorescent hall. Fly free, my friend. Fly free. Robin the Bird, Robbie, if you're hearing this, I hope you're out on a lake fishing somewhere. And if your grandson is cute, I hope you gave him my number. We only had a few hours, but I'll remember our meet cute forever.
That was Mimi Hayes. She's a comedian and wrote a book about her experience. It's called I'll Be Okay, It's Just a Hole in My Head. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jad Slayman. Julian Harris is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. This week, we say goodbye to our associate producer, Alex Stern. She's joining another WHYY show as producer. We'll miss you, Alex, and we wish you the best. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. Tanya English is our editorial director. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated health care.
WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.